This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The 68th season of the Purdue University Northwest Sinai Forum Speaker Series is coming up this fall. We have the list of the speakers, and we have with us to talk about it, Director of the Purdue University Northwest Sinai Forum, Leslie Plesak. Leslie, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Hi, Chris. I'm glad to be here.
What an exciting season of speakers this time, and certainly because we've had all the issues with the COVID-19 pandemic last season, it's going to be really, really, I'm sure, look forward to if we have people showing up in Westville and perhaps other places if the crowds get too big to hear some of these people speak.
Right. I'm excited to get back to live programming. We did pivot last year and offer a couple of virtual programs in the place of our normal season, but one of the best parts of the Sinai Forum is bringing people together in community to listen to the speakers, to engage in dialogue with the speaker and with each other, and certainly to talk about the most important issues of the day. And that's exactly what the forum's been doing for the past 68 seasons.
Mm-hmm. And this year in particular, we're certainly very timely with the issues involving health and medicine and high technology and the like here. Let's get it go. Let's look first here at the first speaker, which is coming up, by the way, on Sunday afternoon, October 17th. Tell us about Dr. Deborah Birks.
Yeah, we're very excited to bring Dr. Birks to the Sinai Forum in October. We're starting a little bit later than we normally do. We normally start in September and end in December, but in an effort to be able to gather in person, we're spreading our season out just a little bit longer this year, and we're starting a little later. Deborah Birks is a great speaker to kick off the forum because of everything that we've lived through in the last 15 months or so. And the topic that she'll be talking about is an overview of the pandemic from the inside. So people may not necessarily know Dr. Birx's name. A lot of people have said they recognize her as the doctor that wears the scarves all the time. She was a part of a lot of the press conferences in the early days of the pandemic. And she's a world-renowned medical expert and leader whose career has focused on clinical and basic immunology, infectious diseases, pandemic preparedness, and she's going to take a look back at the COVID-19 pandemic that we face to look at what can we learn from decisions that were made, and she'll be looking forward at how we can be more prepared when we are faced with something else like this in the future. And of course, there's a lot of politics around the way the pandemic was and is being handled, and you know, so many of us have been impacted by COVID-19 in so many ways, with losses of people that we love and loss of jobs and changes in everything that we've known. And she's a great person because of her background and her pedigree with handling pandemics. She was involved in the AIDS epidemic, the SARS epidemic. So she's a great person to come and talk about what's happened and how we can better be prepared into the future if we're faced with another situation like this.
Now, Leslie, let's take a moment, listen to a little bit of Dr. Birks in a recent interview with Dr. Sanjay Gupta.
Well, I look at it this way. The first time we have an excuse, there were about 100,000 deaths that came from that original surge. All of the rest of them, in my mind, could have been mitigated or decreased substantially. Well, I think you've heard other conversations that people have posted with the president. I would say it was even more direct than what people have heard. It was very uncomfortable, very direct, and very difficult to hear.
Were you threatened?
I would say it was a very uncomfortable conversation.
Coming up after Dr. Birks has her presentation on October 17th, next one up on the list is on November 7th, and Leslie, tell us about Max Eisen.
I'm super excited to have Max Eisen join us. It's interesting, Chris, because we have renegotiated contracts multiple times getting prepared for this season, partly because we had some of our speakers booked in 2020 before the pandemic shut things down. Max Eisen was one of those speakers, and he is a Holocaust survivor. He is a passionate speaker and educator who will share his story of courage, and he warns of the dangers of hatred and discrimination in society. He's an author of a book called By Chance Alone, a remarkable true story of courage and survival at Auschwitz. Max Eisen, I've had the opportunity to talk to him multiple times via phone. He lives in Toronto, and he's going to share the story, the tragic story, but also the incredibly courageous story of how he survived when the majority of his family perished at Auschwitz-Birkenau death camp in May of 1944. He's been telling his story for the last 30 years, and he and I have joked together. I booked him when he was 91. Mm-hmm. He's now 93. And each time I've had to change his date, he said he's looking forward to joining us, God willing. So there will be a day in the not too distant future where we won't have the opportunity to speak directly to survivors of Auschwitz. And so Max Eisen, who was going to join us last year for the 75th anniversary of the liberation, will be joining us on November 7th, as you said, to share his story and, really just keep those things that we need to know about history and the tragedies that we, that he experienced and we face, keep those in the forefront.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Leslie Plesak with Purdue University Northwest Sinai Forum about the 68th season in the speakers series. And the next one on the list coming up on December 5th is Brian Stevenson, a very interesting fellow, I understand.
Yeah, he very much is. And people may know Brian Stevenson. He was the author of Just Mercy, which was a book and a movie that a lot of people watch. But Brian Stevenson is a great speaker. I've had the opportunity to hear him speak. He's the founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, which is a human rights organization in Montgomery, Alabama. And under Brian's leadership, the Equal Justice Initiative has won major legal challenges, eliminating excessive and unfair sentencing, exonerating innocent death row prisoners, and then confronting the abuse of the incarcerated and the mentally ill. And in addition, he's done a lot to initiate major new anti-poverty and anti-discrimination efforts that challenge inequality in America. And so, one of the beauties of the Sinai Forum is that we bring speakers who talk about the most important issues of the day. Brian Stevenson is one of those speakers. Obviously, there has been a lot of racial tension that's come to the forefront over the last, certainly for many, many years. But, it's something that we are all grappling with and looking at. And Brian Stevenson is a compassionate, super interesting lawyer who will talk to us about some of those things. And when I heard him speak in March, he left me with a lot of really interesting things to think about. So I think people will really enjoy hearing Brian Stevenson speak. I've been trying to get Brian Stevenson booked for the Sinai Forum for the last couple of years. So I'm really excited that he'll be joining us in December.
That's great to hear.
That's
great to hear. Well, the Sinai Forum speaker series continues on into 2022. With the first one coming up on January 9th, with Canadian photographer, filmmaker, marine biologist Paul Nicolin. Tell us about Paul and give us an idea if you know what he's going to talk about.
Yeah, so Paul Nicolin is a nature photographer, but he is so much more than that. And as you mentioned, he's a filmmaker, he's a marine biologist, he's a conservationist, he's an adventurer. And we've had photographers in the past, and what I love about bringing someone like Paul Nicolin to the forum is that he doesn't just share the photos that he's taken, but he talks about the stories behind those photos, and then he is somewhat of a climate change expert captured through the lens of his camera. So he was born in British Columbia. He takes a lot of pictures. The topic of his talk is called Into the Icy Realm. So he is very comfortable with cold temperatures, but he talks about global issues like climate change. And then he and his partner, they started a nonprofit called Sea Legacy, which is about ocean conservation. And so he is a person who cares very much about the plight of our planet. And as I've shared information about the forum with people, I say he's got the cool factor. He's a very high energy, interesting speaker who uses photography as a metaphor to talk about life. So I think Paul Nicolin joining us in January 9th of 2022, although it's still a part of our 21 season, will be a great speaker to inform people about the importance of conservation and taking care of this planet that we live on.
Well, that's going to be a very interesting talk to listen to and to be in the room as he does it, to be sure. And finally, the 2021 into 22 season of the Sinai Forum speeches ends with what is entitled An Afternoon with Steve Wozniak, the man who co-founded Apple. Tell us what this Silicon Valley icon is going to talk about.
Yeah, so Steve Wozniak, as a lot of people know, is the co-founder of Apple Computers with Steve Jobs, and we'll be talking to him about innovation and technology. Steve Wozniak was actually awarded the National Medal of Technology in 1985, which is by the President of the United States, and it's the highest honor bestowed to an American who is a leading innovator. And so we're going to talk to him about how he developed his concept, but to me it's about how does he as a person approach something that obviously he was passionate about, and did he have any idea that it would go on to change the way that we do business and we operate in the world? He also in December of 2020 launched his company eForce, which aims to use cryptocurrency and blockchain technology to make it cheaper and easier for companies to fund green projects. And I don't know a lot about blockchain technology. I know what we'll do is we'll talk to him about his, you know, his ideas, his businesses. But we're also going to talk to him and every speaker at the forum about how they got their start. Who are they as a person? Because I think what leaves our subscribers really, you know, kind of blown away each time we have a program is that they get to know our speakers up close and personal. And the Sinai Forum brings some of the biggest names in technology and medicine and in the arts and entertainment to the stage of the forum here in Northwest Indiana. So it truly is a gem that Purdue Northwest offers to people. And Steve Wozniak is going to be a conversation about all of that. Who is he as a person? How did he get his start? And how can we, those of us who are interested in innovation, also change the world? So I think it's going to be a really interesting conversation.
And that's the last in the series for the season. And that's going to be on Sunday, February 6th, 2022. And once again, it's like all the others in the series. The season ticket sales are going to be starting soon. And if you would, Leslie, please tell us how people can get season tickets in particular for the Sinai Forum this time around.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. So the way that it works is we offer tickets to our past subscribers beginning on July 6th, which is next Tuesday. They get a week window to purchase tickets for their loyalty, and then tickets go on sale to the general public on Tuesday, July 13th, and people can visit our website. I don't know if you want me to share that now,
yes,
or we can share it at the end, but the website is the best place to go and look at tickets. What's really great about this year is we're offering our live season tickets, and with every live season ticket, there will also be links to watch the programs virtually if preferred, so that if, you know, something happens and a person is uncomfortable or unable to attend the program in person, they'll be able to watch that program on their own device. And then what's new this year is we're also offering a virtual season ticket. So if someone knows that they're not ready to come back to our venue in person, they can purchase a virtual ticket, which includes a link for each program. They won't be able to attend in person, but each person who purchases that ticket is able to attend all five programs virtually. And that ticket sells for $100. So it's a really great price for all five programs.
Well, that's great to know, Leslie.
Yeah. So that's something new that came out of COVID for us is just, really, the industry in general is kind of shifting in terms of the way that it's offering programming. So for us, it'll be hybrid programming, both live and virtual, so that we can accommodate people's, ability to come in person, and as I said earlier, bringing people back to the Sinai Forum live is really in my opinion, the very, very best way to watch the programs.
Now, we should mention now that there is a big list of this year's sponsors for the Sinai Forum Speaker Series, and you can see that list in all detail, as well as find out more about the speakers we've been talking about in our conversation for this 68th season of the Purdue University Northwest Sinai Forum on the website. And that website address is?
Our website is pnw.edu/Sinai-forum. So that's pnw.edu/Sinai, spelled S-I-N-A-I hyphen, and then forum, F-O-R-U-M. And I appreciate you bringing up our sponsors because the Sinai Forum and Purdue Northwest are so grateful for the support that we've received from our sponsors, from our grantors, and from our subscribers and individual donors. We couldn't do it without them. The ability to bring the programming that we have over the last few years is very much correlated to the support that we've received from the community. So we're so grateful for that.
Well, Leslie Plesak, thank you for spending time with us today to talk about the 68th season of the Purdue Northwest Sinai Forum, which, as we mentioned, is going to begin with the first speaker, Dr. Deborah Birks, on October 17th. In fact, the tickets are going to be going on sale in July. Be aware of that. Check the website for more details. And thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking to talk about it today.
Thank you, Chris. It's always a pleasure to join you and to be able to share the season with your listeners.
This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. The Pfizer vaccine has already been approved for youngsters aged 12 through 15, and the FDA approval for the Moderna vaccine for children is on the horizon. So it all means that parents should be able to make an informed decision very soon about whether or not to vaccinate their children. Now, let's find out more about it by talking with Dr. Christina Johns. She's a pediatrician who is also the chief medical advisor for the organization called PM Pediatrics, which is a pediatric urgent care provider. In fact, they have a couple of facilities in the Chicagoland area. And Dr. Johns, thank you for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we seem to be very close to at least having two vaccines. And we know already that one vaccine has already been approved for young people. And there's also concern, I guess, parents now have to make a very serious decision if they have not yet already. What can we do to first off, make sure that we have youngsters under the age of 12 properly vaccinated?
So under the age group of 12, we are still waiting to see some of the safety and effectiveness and dosing data. And based on the timeline, we're getting the sense that that will probably come out during some point during the fall, perhaps early fall. So for the younger age group right now, they are in the vulnerable, unvaccinated group, and I think that that is important for parents to keep in mind, especially as the Delta variant is starting to emerge. For older kids, 12 and above, those children are eligible to get the Pfizer vaccine right now. It's safe and effective, and so would encourage them to do so.
What are some of the facts that parents can look at in order to be able to make a really informed decision on whether their youngsters need to be vaccinated?
You know, I think that it is very important to know that the safety and effectiveness data from Pfizer that was released and was part of what was used for the FDA to grant the EUA extension, that's available for public consumption that you can very easily find on the internet if you want to look at the primary data and look at the safety and effectiveness data. That it was incredibly reassuring and was quite safe. In addition to that, I would encourage parents who have concerns to speak to their child's healthcare professional, to their pediatrician. This is the person who does have the scientific training and the background to be able to vet what information is out there. And gosh, there's a lot of it. We've been drinking from a fire hose for this last year of all of the information that we are seeing online that's been released and all of the rapidly emerging data. This your child's pediatrician is the person who can help you sort through that information and also who happens to know your child and your child's medical history the best. That person is the best person who can guide you about making the decision that's best for your child.
Now, we know that many parents may think that the information that's out there about the vaccine is coming directly from medical or scientific studies, and it is accurate, but it's not easy for the layperson to understand. What do you suggest parents do in this type of scenario?
you know, I agree. It is difficult for a layperson to understand. And so what I'm recommending to people is they do what I call triangulate the data. So if you see something online and you want to fact check it, take a look at the CDC's website or your state and local Department of Health and see if you can find some supporting information there. In addition, cross-check it with a local academic university or academic medical center, for example, and see if, in addition, does that information show up there? And finally, does it show up with your pediatrician's website, an online board-certified physician that you might trust? If you are seeing it show up in multiple different outlets, then you know that it may have some legitimate legs there, and that could be something that could be trusted. The sharing of random videos, anecdotal stories with cases of one or two, that is not data. And so it's important to learn and recognize the difference. If you're confused about that difference, again, this is where your healthcare professional is your ally and your advocate. Use them.
We're talking with Dr. Christina Johns. She is a nationally recognized pediatrician. She's also the senior medical advisor for PM Pediatrics, which is a nationwide and region-wide pediatric urgent care provider. Dr. Johns, are you noting that there may be more cases and in turn more hospitalization of COVID for teenagers? Is it on the rise, as the CDC has said?
Well, it shouldn't be surprising to anybody that the vulnerable populations are going to be a larger percentage of the COVID-19 cases, and that is indeed what we're seeing. Certainly with the Delta variant that is more transmissible, we are very concerned that we're going to see even more. And so because so many of the younger population either isn't eligible for the vaccine or hasn't gotten their vaccine yet, we are seeing a larger percentage or proportion of these cases. In addition, remember that more activities are opening up, restrictions being lifted, kids are congregating again. And so it's really no surprise that cases may be on the rise in this group.
Now, are we finding maybe if a youngster happens to have or showing the signs of COVID, how safe is it that for them to make it into a pediatric urgent care facility like a PM?
You know, the good news is that all medical offices, hospitals, have become really excellent in terms of minimizing exposure for patients and families who come in for a medical visit. So I would really encourage people that there's no need to be concerned about going to the doctor or going for an evaluation. The appropriate infection control measures are in place. They have been working for a year now, and so seek care when you need it.
Now, we know that the approval has already been made, as we mentioned earlier, for the Pfizer vaccine, and the FDA is working on one for Moderna for youngsters. Is it close, perhaps, for having youngsters under the age of 12 or around 12 to 15 being vaccinated? Or how much do we have to wait until before the age group actually gets full approval before they can be vaccinated?
You know, it's a good question. We are all waiting and anticipate that it's going to be soon that Moderna will have their EUA extended, just like Pfizer did. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be great news. When there's more access to more vaccine, that means the potential for us to get it into kids' arms and to protect them safely.
Now, we know that we've heard a lot, of course, about the Delta variant. It's spreading around the nation, and there is concern, of course, even with adults, but are youngsters more at risk for serious illness with the Delta variant than some of the others? And would the vaccine be able to protect it for them against the variant?
Right now, we know that the mRNA vaccines are effective against the Delta variant. The Delta variant, the data shows so far, and again, it's early, so I think that's a really important thing to note, that this may change as more data emerges, but right now we are not seeing more serious infection in children from the Delta variant, but we do know that it is more highly transmissible. So it's in the early innings. We're watching very, very closely to see how it's going to affect this younger population.
Now, Dr. Johns, we are about to at least finish up our conversation today, and this, I guess to close things out, if there are parents that are still on the fence about getting their youngsters vaccinated, what would you say to them?
I would say that it is absolutely okay to have questions. It is okay to be concerned. I would really encourage every parent with concerns or hesitation to get their answers, not in an online social media group, as many have done, and to make sure they are speaking to a trusted science, a trusted healthcare professional. The most ideal person is your child's pediatrician. That's their business, to advocate for your child, and they're best suited to do it.
Dr. Johns, thank you for being with us to talk about the subject, and let's hope that we get finally approval for, at least for Moderna, to be out there available, as well as the Pfizer vaccine for young people 12 to 15, and stay healthy and safe in trying to deal with the issues these days. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Christina Johns is a nationally recognized pediatrician. She's also the senior medical advisor for PM Pediatrics. A new electric vehicle company has completed its purchase of the old Hummer plant in Mishawaka and went public on NASDAQ on Monday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jacob Lazaro reports Electric Last Mile Solutions plans to start production this fall.
ELMS is planning to make small electric utility vans, like what your cable technician or plumber might use. CEO James Taylor says compared to passenger cars, it's an untapped market in the United States.
We really want to take advantage of being first mover status. There is nobody in that segment now with any electric vans.
And they're hiring immediately to start production this fall. Taylor says they hope to have 50 employees at the plant by August and 100 by the end of the year. The plant was previously purchased by Seres Automotive, a U.S.-based subsidiary of Chinese company Chongqing Socon Industry Group. Seres spent about $20 million upgrading the plant to make electric SUVs, but ended up canceling those plans due to shifts in the market. At the time, Taylor was the CEO of Seres, and he also oversaw the Hummer brand before it was retired in 2010. He says that history put EMLS in the right place at the right time.
I'll start a new company. I'll buy the plant from you. Then if you supply the parts, you know, we have a deal.
The vans have a range of 150 miles and cost $25,000 after a federal EV tax credit. ELMS stock debuted at $11.56 a share on Monday. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jacob Lazaro.
Ivy Tech Community College won't be raising its tuition for the next two academic years in an effort to make college more affordable. Here's Adam Pinsker with more.
Ivy Tech is freezing tuition at all 19 of its campuses for the 2021-2022 and 2022-23 academic school years. Ivy Tech Bloomington Chancellor Jenny Vaughn says the school is also paying for all student textbook fees for at least the next academic school year.
A lot of students just don't purchase their books at all. Some wait to see if that you know, maybe a couple weeks in, they finally decide, okay, I got the money now, I can go buy that book.
The tuition freeze applies to full and part-time students. Vaughn says the goal is to lessen the financial burden on Ivy Tech students who have to balance work and classes. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Adam Pinsker.
IU researchers have found a helpful microbe in the stomachs of queen bees and their larvae that can fight deadly fungi. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel tells us, researchers are hoping this discovery will eventually lead to medicine that can protect the honeybees that Hoosier farmers rely on.
More than 40% of honeybee colonies in the U.S. die every year, threatening the nation's food security. Just like with cows or pigs, some beekeepers will treat their bees with antibiotics to prevent diseases. But IU researchers say overusing these antibiotics could be killing off a helpful microbe that protects the queen and her young from fungal diseases. Irene Newton is an associate professor of biology at IU. She says we see something similar in people. If you take antibiotics to treat a bacterial infection,
simultaneously, you will also kill off a lot of your normal microflora. And this leaves you susceptible to opportunistic pathogens that can really take hold and lead to long-term serious effects.
IU researchers say this discovery could eventually lead to medicine that could help worker bees, a pollinator-safe pesticide, or more. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. There's an organization called the Gary Literacy Coalition, which may not be the, but one of the, no doubt, City of Gary's best-kept secrets. And we're going to find out more about the Literacy Coalition by speaking to the executive director, Lori Kirkendall. Lori, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
Will you first give us an idea what the mission and the vision of the coalition is all about?
All right. Well, the mission of the Gary Literacy Coalition is to support, promote, enhance, and coordinate the accessibility of literacy opportunities, thus making Gary a reading city.
Mm-hmm.
And our vision statement is that Gary, Indiana, will become a literate community known as a reading city, with every individual having access to literacy opportunities.
Okay. Now, the coalition has been around for a while. It's not a new organization, is it?
No, the Gary Literacy Coalition has been around for 20 years. We started this organization in January of 2001.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the initial things that the organizers of the coalition, to your knowledge, had to face in the city of Gary in particular in getting such an organization started?
Well, our founder is Dr. Steve Simpson, which is a pediatrician who still practices in the city of Gary today,
mm-hmm.
and it was his brainchild. What we found out is that Gary faces serious literacy challenges. With over 70% of its adult population, and those are people who are 16 and older, were functioning at a low level of literacy. This situation handcuffs the process of our community and is a result of a generational cycle of inadequate educational advancement. We get a side effect of loss of businesses, loss of jobs, reduced tax revenues, chronic unemployment, rising health care costs, and soaring criminal activity. So it's really important that we begin to support our community by making sure that they're literate, and this will also help to alleviate those things that make Gary have challenges for Gary citizens.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking not only about young people, but about grown-ups as well, too, here. Because as you mentioned, it's an intergenerational issue that comes up. Maybe 20 years ago, a child didn't get quite the education or the help in an education that he or she should have had. And unfortunately, it follows through into adulthood. So you have a grown-up that has issues as well, too. So that's just probably, I'm sure, one of the many challenges that the Gary Literacy Coalition finds.
Right, and we are all-inclusive, age-inclusive. We go from prenatal to elderly, so we do everything. One of the what we do with our program is, with the program that we do with Dr. Simpson and Reach Out and Read, is we start to get mothers to begin to read to their children in the womb and very early to start that early learning literacy program. So every time that a child from the birth to 5 months goes to the pediatrician for their well baby checkups.
Mm-hmm.
The Gary pediatricians that we work with give the child a book, and they also talk to the parent about how important it is to read to their child, and this is for brain and language development. Plus, it's a precursor for learning, so when the child gets to school age, they already have a thirst for knowledge, thus helping them to be better students.
Are you finding that this will also, I guess, in time, if it's done well, help foster better civic engagement, get people more interested in their community, and maybe even bring up some public officials people that would decide to run for office and successfully, and that in turn is going to kind of pass that along?
Yes, I believe it will. We're seeing that happen. We've been doing it for 20 years, and what we're finding out now is even with the children, usually the kids end up finishing that program at 5 years old, but what we're finding out now is they were so used to getting books at five that now as they're getting older and they're in the third and fourth and fifth and sixth grade and they're still going to the pediatrician and saying, hey, where are my books at? So now we've expanded our program to encompass older children as well. So we're definitely making an impact in the community by getting children and encouraging children to read.
We're talking with Lori Kirkendall, who's the executive director of the Gary Literacy Coalition. And Lori, I know that this is a project that goes beyond just principles and good ideas and ideals. There are some real-world incidents that we probably should talk about that show how important a program like this is. And we're talking about even people like a teenage mom who's a dropout from school.
Yes, if they were dropping out and they were a teenage mom, now this is an opportunity not only for mom, but for her to help her baby as well. By coming in and doing our prenatal program, where she goes to the pediatrician, now she's seeing an opportunity while she's learning to teach her child how to read, she's learning to read herself. And then we also do linkages. So when a parent comes in and they identify that and they're in a nurturing environment, we have a lot of parents to say, hey, I want to read better too. And then we're able to guide them to outside resources to help them improve their literacy levels as well.
I know that you mentioned as another example is that of a grandmother who probably didn't have the same advantages when she was a child, and now she has to help out her grandkids.
Exactly. And we provide all those resources, and we have plenty of parents when we work with the Gary Community School Corporation and the charter schools. We have a lot of parents that call us on the phone, and they want their grandchildren, and they're saying, hey, how do I get them to read?
Mm-hmm.
How do I get them to do better in school? And that's one of the things that we're trying to do with the Gary Literacy Coalition is to push a new city initiative that if you read just 20 minutes a day, anything, and that's anybody, over a period of time, you are going to increase your literacy levels. Just 20 minutes a day. It can be a book, it can be a magazine, it can be the newspaper, but just constantly reading is the only way that you're going to get better at reading.
Now, can the Gary Literacy Coalition help adults, young adults like young men maybe that don't have a high school diploma, they're going for a GED, but they have to pass the exam, and their reading skills are not up to snuff?
What we do with the Gary Literacy Coalition is when we find other programs, because we want to be that literacy linkage. So here, personally, we don't do tutoring, but we get information and resources from all around the area. And when we find someone, they call in, they say, hey, I need help with my reading. What we end up doing is turning around and pointing them to the right resources in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So we will, if we can't help you, we will definitely try to link you to someone that can.
Mm-hmm.
We are also partnered with Methodist Hospital. Because with the rising healthcare costs, literacy rates are also part of that. People can't read their prescriptions. They don't understand the doctor's instructions.
Oh, yeah.
And that makes the healthcare. And so Methodist Hospital really does support the Gary Literacy Coalition in helping to raise our literacy levels so that we can help our people with health disparities in our neighborhoods as well.
Now, I know this probably is part of certainly the vision and the mission of the Literacy Coalition, but what are some of the targeted areas that you and your colleagues like to focus on?
Well, we focus on, you mean regionally or demographics?
Mm-hmm.
Regionally, we service the whole city of Gary, and we also service areas outside the Gary community. So we have partnered with Maryville and Crown Point and Hammond and East Chicago to provide literacy opportunities. And as I said before, we're age inclusive. We go prenatal all the way to the elderly.
Well, yeah, it certainly sounds that way, that from young people all the way through to young adults to older adults, it's all an issue that has to be dealt with in some way to be able to help resolve it for individuals as well as, I suppose, communities too.
Yes.
If anybody's interested in learning more about the Gary Literacy Coalition, how can they find out more?
Well, they can visit our Facebook page, and they can also visit our website.
And Lori Kirkendall, thank you very much for spending time talking about, and maybe to some people here, introducing them to the Gary Literacy Coalition. And we hope we have a chance to find out more in the future, and thank you for spending time with us today. Lori Kirkendall is the Executive Director of the Gary Literacy Coalition. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. And coming up tomorrow, we have a special Best of Regionally Speaking for you, Tourism Edition. We'll have conversations with Gary Chamber of Commerce Executive Director Chuck Hughes, with Indiana Dunes Tourism Executive Director Lorelei Weimer, and Spiros Batistatos, the Executive CEO and Executive Director of the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority. We hope you'll join us for tomorrow's show.